psalm that we just sing of is one of these historical psalms, Psalm 105, in which we trace all kinds of historical events of Abraham and of Joseph and of Israel and Moses and so on. But notice what the psalm is really about. It's not about people. It's about God. It's about the great deeds of God. And that's what we just sang. That introduction of the psalm is indeed like this. Sing unto him and talk you of all his wondrous works. And as we tonight again pick up Joseph once more out of Joseph's story in Genesis 41, it's not about Joseph. Even though Joseph is here, the person, of course, that stands in the center, it's about the God of Joseph and how he is leading Israel and Joseph to the fulfillment of the promise of the gospel. So this evening, let's look at this chapter of Genesis 41. And I called my sermon this evening, The Victory of God's Grace. And chapter 41 presents Joseph with his fiercest fire yet he's ever met with. And that may surprise you a little bit, because chapter 41 looks like a pretty upbeat chapter for Joseph. It's not. It's the fiercest fire that young Joseph has to face. And so the second thought is the victory of this grace, which is coming out clear in Joseph's confession in the end of this chapter. And that's where we'll get our text from mostly, when we come to verses 51 and 52. And we need here Joseph naming his firstborn and his secondborn Manasseh and Ephraim. So chapter 41 in Joseph's life is the fiercest fire the young man has yet to face. I must not misread Joseph chapter 41 as Joseph's deliverance out of prison. That's what we often do when we read this chapter. Somehow Joseph finally gets the reward upon all his obedience or so. He's obeyed the Lord faithfully, and he's been faithful in Potiphar's house and faithful in the prison's house, and now, as it were, Joseph is getting the rewards. Not a good reward he got then, if that's what it was, as you will soon see. It's true, of course, that Joseph experienced some deliverance in this chapter. He is out of the hands of the prison, the dungeon that he was in. But it is not true that when he gets to this position in Egypt, that this is deliverance. I was thinking about, I think, chapter 39, sold in the pit, sold to the Ishmaelites, the Midianites, Potiphar's house, dungeon. It's like being in a slow waters, cold, but manageable, slow and cold. When you get to 41, Joseph gets into the white water, the swift current with whirlpools and currents that are going to take him much deeper than he's ever had so far. And if you grasp that, then you'll understand chapter 41 in Joseph's life. In the theme of this message, the victory of God's grace. Now let's just for a moment briefly look at the chapter details, very brief. The story is known. Joseph's elevation from the prison to the palace, from the rags of prison to the robes of the governor of Egypt. It's an amazing story, I agree. I love reading this chapter. Right? It's one of our favorites when we are kids. When we read about the dream of Pharaoh. It's a typical Egyptian dream. Nile River, of course, is crucial. It's like the God. And in that Nile River, if you would go there in the days today, you'd still see the water buffalo standing in the water just with their head above it. They love to stand in those rivers. So as Pharaoh sees these fat buffaloes, as it were, coming out of the river, followed by the lean ones, it's not an uncommon scene, except what is uncommon, of course, is the fat and the lean. And on the shores of the Nile River are the lush gardens, the granaries. The granary of the world was Egypt in Joseph's days, and they were indeed highly irrigated areas around the Nile River. And then you notice that Pharaoh is troubled by the dream, and he is realizing this is more than just a dream. Gets all the magicians together. Nobody's able to answer. Joseph comes out of the prison. And he explains the dream. If you read the explanation, you say, wow, that wasn't such a difficult thing to explain after all. We could have almost guessed it. No, not really guessed it, but you know, the details of it are not so bizarre. And yet it was hidden from the magicians, those wise men. It was hidden from Pharaoh. It was clear to Joseph. Now, how come Joseph have this insight? The ones indeed hidden from the wise and prudent and revealed unto the babes, the children of God, in this case Joseph. But the most impressive congregation is not the interpretation of the dream. Most impressive is the wise statesman's like counsel Joseph immediately adds after the explanation of the dream, as we read in verse 33 to 36, when Joseph adds, now what should you do, Pharaoh? Do this, appoint someone who becomes the deputy over all this, and gather the good food in these good years and lay it up, and so that there will be enough food for the years to come. Joseph here speaks beyond personal experience. Joseph here speaks clearly led by the Spirit of God, as he not only interprets the dream, but gives his very wise counsel. Now, the third thing I want you to notice about the story of Joseph is how he honored God from the beginning to the end. First thing he says to Pharaoh, no, the interpretation is not for me, Pharaoh, you're wrong about that. The interpretation is for my God. Joseph is not afraid. Here he stands as a little man before this superpower man. Egypt was a superpower in those days. This was the ruler of the known world then. And he's not afraid to tell this man to his face, the gods of the Nile River, the gods that you serve, nothing compared to my God. Your gods fail. Your magicians are standing there, they failed it. My God will tell me what the dream means. Notice how bold and yet how beautiful Joseph is in confessing and honoring the God of Israel before the wise men. And again in verse 32 he adds, and that dream was doubled because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now, here we have in brief the story of Joseph. But it's not all that cheery as it looks like. Joseph is now ushered into a fire that burns fiercer than he's ever met before. Just walk along with me for a moment, as from this moment Joseph's life is changed. Radically changed. The temptations he now faces are bigger than the one he faced with Potiphar's wife. The fire that he now faces is bigger than he ever faced with his brothers, the way they lived. What is it then that makes this chapter a fearful temptation for Joseph? Well, from being with his Jacob, his father, his God-fearing father, Joseph now becomes the intimate servant of one of the most pagan kings in the world, Pharaoh. Notice in verse 37, as Pharaoh is immediately adopting Joseph, thou shalt be over my house, and according to thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne I'll be greater than I. From this moment on, Joseph is going to interact with an utterly pagan Pharaoh on a daily basis. And he's going to rule next to this man, or below this man, but next to this man. Joseph is still a slave in chapter 41. He's still a slave. Instead of now the slave of Potiphar, he is now the servant and the slave of Pharaoh. But still a slave. Except along with his position comes an amount of temptation that only if the grace of God would not have kept this man would have swept him off his feet. Joseph is in the wrong land, serving the wrong leader of the wrong nation. At home, he had his dreams. To his imagination, they probably felt pretty good. That he saw himself as a chief sheaf and all the other sheaves were bowing down to him. He saw himself as a chief planet and all the stars were bowing down to him. But that was only a dream. But now it's reality. You read in verse 43. And he made him ride in the second chariot. And they cried before him, bow the knee. Imagine there. He goes in the land in the chariot of Pharaoh, the second best, all through the land, and everybody's bowing down before Joseph, honoring him. And in those next 7 years, not just honoring him, idolizing him. Every time they hear, go to Joseph, go to Joseph. And they go to Joseph. And it is Joseph that is, as it were, helping and saving these people, congregation. He is being honored here in a great way. He's being worshipped here. Oh, that's tempting. That's very tempting. That's the fiercest fire that Joseph faces at this moment. When he was born, his mother gave him a name, Joseph. That meant a plea to God for help. But notice in verse 44, 45, Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah. Now most of your margins will give a beautiful explanation of this name. In my margin it says it's in the Coptic, revealer of secrets, or the man to whom secrets are revealed, but they're only guesses really. Nobody really knows what that name means. It's nice to think it would mean that way, and it would be very nice. But we really don't know what that name really means, except we know it's a pagan name. It's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did to Daniel and the three friends. He gave them a pagan name. He wanted to identify this man with a pagan nation, and therefore Joseph wasn't good enough. You need a heathen name, because I want you to be one of us, just like us, to identify you with us pagans. You have to remember, in the Bible times, names were not just picked because they're nice. They're picked to identify you. You feel the fire is getting hot here for Joseph. There's pressure on every side for him to begin to identify with this pagan nation. There's many name changes in Genesis. Abram to Abraham, Jacob to Israel. But they were by God. But this is a name change by a pagan king in order to, as it were, submerge Joseph into the pagan culture. And lastly, it's obvious that he was a single man. So Pharaoh goes through his household and he finds him a wife, the wife of Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of An. You couldn't get a worse one to be your wife. She wasn't just a pagan. She was the daughter of a very prestigious priest in the Hebrew religion. Probably a daughter immersed in all the heathenness of the Egyptian culture. Now you see why I say that chapter 41 is like the white waters compared to the previous chapters, calm but cold water. This is the most dangerous part of Joseph's life that he has ever faced yet. For now he also has an utterly pagan wife in contrast to what his father Abram sought for his grandfather Isaac and what his father Jacob found in the at least the daughters of Laban. And we all know what the influence of a woman would be on Joseph. He used to interface with her daily. So now, when we add all this up for a moment, can we still think of chapter 41 as a chapter of Joseph's deliverance? I hope you agree with me. That's a misname for the chapter. This is a further and a fiercer trial of young Joseph. The world's beatings kill for far less than the world's kisses, is what Matthew Henry writes somewhere. He says the beatings of the world, Joseph's brothers, Potiphar's wife, Potiphar, the dungeon, all those are the beatings that this young Joseph received unjustly and unfairly throughout his journey. But now the world is kissing him. Everything comes to his favor. Money, prestige, status, honor, luxury. He got Egyptian credit card without limits. This man has it made. The world is at his fingertips. Can you see with me? These 30 years of his life has brought him now to the summit of all the prestige and the wealth and the power and the influence you could ever imagine. And therefore, I keep on saying to you tonight that pit in which he was thrown and the slavery in Potiphar's house and the transfer to the dungeon were sparks. But at the palace is the full blaze testing this young man Joseph. That's not deliverance. Be alerted, therefore, dear congregation. Far fewer survive the test of prosperity and freedom than the test and pressure of poverty, sickness, and slavery. And that's why the Christianity in this country is so pathetic. So hollow, so lukewarm, so shallow, so powerless, so weak. Why? The world's kisses kill, but the world's beatings bless. You see it in Joseph's life. We have such a wrong view of prosperity, because when we read chapter 1, we all think, now it is going good for Joseph. It isn't. Well, it was. And eventually it was, but it was dangerous for Joseph. William Gurnall, Saint Puritan of old, he says the same spots are mostly gotten in the peace and the plenty and the prosperity. And another one added this: I am never afraid for my brethren who have many troubles, but I am often trembling for those of my brothers whose career is prosperous and whose way is easy. Can you see why? Let's together sing before we consider our second thought. Psalter 327. Verses 1 through 4. Lord, thy word to me remember, thou hast made me hope in thee. In Psalter 327, let us do all four verses.
To remember Thou hast made me hope in thee.
We've seen something of Josephus' trial. It's a new look at this chapter. I'm sure for most of us, for me it was also, a surprising look. But then we come secondly to Joseph's clear confession, which is the victory of God's grace. Let's remind ourselves it's not the history of people that the Bible writes about. It's the history, stories, and life stories of people indeed. But it's not, that's not the focus of the Bible. The focus of the Bible is the history of redemption. It's the history of God's work. And God is at work through the lives of Adam and Eve and Abram and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and so on. It's His works. That is the story. Also through the very people's lives events. And what is His greatest work is to glorify Himself in the redeeming of sinners. Remember, the story of the Bible is the story of the battle between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And here we have a beautiful victory of the God in the seed of the woman. Though that Satan did all he could, as it were, get Joseph to derail from where God placed him in the beginning of his life. And God does that indeed, that glorifying of Himself to the amazing life crises of people like you and me. And as I studied this chapter, I often thought throughout my studies, what did Joseph really think? What did go on in his heart? I know what goes on in my heart and everybody pat on my shoulder. I wouldn't want a congregation to bow down before me. Well, maybe I do. Because that feels good. How did Joseph deal with that? All these people bowing down before him, giving him the honor and the great glory, and that is thinking of him and speaking of him, especially when these years of famine came and they came to him to get all that food. And no doubt they thanked him over and over and over. Well, let's at least conclude that he didn't stand that far away from you and me at all. They're all of like passions as we are. Do not put Joseph on some pedestal. Except that the grace of God kept him. That's the only way you can answer. Why this young man in this crisis of his life didn't topple over, as it were, from the pedestal that God placed him on, it's because God kept him from all that sin and temptation that he felt. And when finally we see the victory of God's grace in Joseph's life, we are to bow down before God. Now, where's the victory? Let's turn in our chapter 2, verse 50, 51 and 52. 50 and 51 and 2. Gives us a little insight in how Joseph eventually dealt with these sudden changes in the circumstances. In verses 50 to 52, congregation, we get to see the inside of Joseph in the midst of all this, what he has experienced. Naming his two sons was his opportunity to confess his faith in God and in his faithfulness as he led him. You see, Joseph had no choice in all the other things. He had no choice that he was lifted off from the dungeon floor to sit on the second seat of the governor of Egypt. He had no choice about that. He had no choice about the wife he got. He had no choice about the name he received. He had no choice about all what Pharaoh gave him. He must have lived in the best or the most beautiful palace or something like that. He had no choice about these things. That was all done to him. Because remember, he is Pharaoh's slave. While he is second in control, he is at his mercy. But he has a choice in naming his two sons. Naming his two sons was his personal opportunity to confess something. You have to remember now from all what has taken place. He's been here now between, he was 17 when he was kidnapped and sold. He's 30 now. We read that in verse 46. Somewhere after this, his sons are born before the 7 years of famine come, it says. So Joseph is almost 20 years immersed into Egypt. Speaks fluent Egypt. No accent. Later on, when those brothers hear him speak Egypt, he did no accent. He didn't guess. He's Hebrew. He is so immersed in the Egyptian culture. He's working daily in this pagan society. He's working with pagans. He is surrounded with none of his own for nearly 20 years. There's no Bible in Joseph's life. No written scripture. There's no father. No godly friends. It's not a Sabbath day kept in Jerusalem, in Egypt. None. And that goes on for over 20 years already. He's daily bombarded with the Egyptians' levels of corruption. You think Clinton is corrupt, or you think Trump is corrupt, or the others are corrupt. It's been the same story ever since. All those who are on high level are corrupt. Because power corrupts. Unless there is grace, unless there is sanctifying and regenerating grace in the person, power always corrupts a person. So don't be surprised. But Joseph is working in the midst of that. He's working with these people who are always out there in opportunistic ways to get competition and power struggle and feasting. You can name it. It all is there for Joseph. A fierce fight. And then he gets the choice to name his own son, and he purposely chooses two Hebrew names, Manasseh and Ephraim. That must have sounded a little odd in Egypt to have a name like that. But Joseph does it purposely. As a father, he has a choice, and his choice is, I will not reject my heritage. I want to be identified with my Hebrew roots. I want everyone to know that I am still committed to what I grew up with. My father's God, my father's land, my father's promises. And in these two names that Joseph gives to his children, we see the victory of God's grace. I think if Satan has teeth, he would have been grinding his teeth in anger when he heard Joseph name his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. He lost it by God's grace. And now before we look at those two names, I'm going to ask you a question. Is this grace visible in our confession and in our choices? Joseph is not ashamed in that pagan culture to speak clearly about whom he belongs to and whom he wants to belong to. Is that clear to you? I mean, is that clear to others in your life? Are we distinctly confessing ourselves to whom we belong? And here we are still surrounded by a majority of Christian people, at least they call themselves. Are we as bold and courageous and faithful as Joseph was? Or are we kind of submerging with this world around us? Are we living separately in the world? Yes, but not of the world. Rather, in the Word, or living out of the Word, boldly, decisively, standing out, to God I belong. And what I name myself, no, I don't have to name myself, but in other ways that you can identify yourself as a Christian. Now, Joseph confessed his faith in the name of his firstborn called Manasseh. The word Manasseh in the Hebrew means forgetting. And Joseph gives his own explanation about why he chose that name. For he says, "For God has made me forget all my toil and my father's house." That does not mean I have forgotten my father's house. That's not what that means. But I have forgotten all that took place in my father's house. And ever since. That's what that means. I have forgotten all the toil. The word toil is the hardship that I have experienced since my father's house, since my brothers ostracized me, rejected me, threw me in the pit, sold me, and ever since I have forgotten the toil of my father's house ever since. Congregation, this is remarkable. If there will be one man justified to be embittered, it would be Joseph. The way he'd been treated, he's not embittered at all. He says, God has healed me. God has made me forget all what they have done to me. I don't dwell on it. You know, this young man is a victim of abuse, violent abuse. This man has been violated in his personal rights. People has ruined his life. He has been robbed of his youth since he was 17 until he is 30, a mature age in those days. His life is a story of injustice and oppression and pain, and undoubtedly there are also among us here who struggle with stories of the past that have shredded you, hurt you, pained you by injustices, by abuses, by violating your rights or your dignities of your person. Maybe a story of great pain with baggage that you are carrying from your past into today. And yet I don't meet an embittered Joseph here. I don't meet a man plotting for revenge. Imagine he could have easily made revenge. He's second in control. He could say, okay, let's get these chariots, let's get some soldiers, let me march you down to Canaan, and let's get my brothers. And let's stick him into this jail for the next 13 years. Now that's what flesh would do. But this is not flesh only. It's the grace of God victorious in the life of Joseph. He's not bitter, not cynical, not hostile, not even an atheist. Isn't that wonderful? For the God he used to serve and speak about with his father Jacob has left him for 13 years without a single instance of, I'm still with you. And I don't mean an atheist here who says, I'm done with that God. All what he said and promised and all what I had in my heart and all what I loved, he has left me. Amazing. That's not about Joseph, right? Now you see the theme of my sermon this evening, the victory of God's grace. Here we have an example of someone who indeed was not lost to God because God kept him. And friends, for you a lesson, there's only one able to make you get beyond your past. It's the same God of Joseph. He can make you and be healed from your past. His grace and his power in Joseph would not allow his life to be defined by his past. Now, when I do counseling, you meet a lot of people who are defining today by the past. Spiritually, emotionally, relationally, socially. And we can talk all hours in the day. But there's only one who is able to make us forget the past in such a way that it will no more affect me today. And who is that? Listen, Manasseh. For God has made me forget the toil of my father's house and beyond. So choosing his name, Manasseh, even that is amazing. That Joseph willingly identifies himself with a family of which he had every reason to be ashamed. And when I observed that thought, I saw, here we have Christ. The Hebrew author says, he is not ashamed to call them his brethren. Who? Who is the dumb? People like you and me. Remember that second sermon from Joseph? We're not any better than Joseph's brethren, right? We don't sell our brothers, but we reject the Savior. We don't sell our brothers to the Midianites, but we will easily sell Christ for a little pleasure. And he's not ashamed. This great is Joseph. To call such sinners his brethren. See, Manasseh. May I ask you, do you have your Manasseh in your life? Or are you defining your life by your past treatment to excuse your present behavior? You know, if Joseph would have been cynical and bitter, you say, I can understand that. When in the next couple chapters he sees his brethren, yeah, I could have understood if you would fry him in the fire. But he didn't. Joseph is not letting himself be determined and ruined. No, he doesn't use his past to excuse bad behavior today or choices and reactions that are totally wrong and sinful. If you are treated unfairly and unjustly by your family or by your friends or by your church or by your co-workers, is that something that you're reverberating, as it were, in your mind over and over and over and dwelling on it and feeding your own on it? That's only going to make it worse. Or is your life characterized by this Joseph faith in him, whom you have learned to know and to serve and to follow and to trust and to leave him, as we saw last week, all the injustice? For he's a just God who one day will take up the cause of justice and right every wrong. That's the comfort. That brings healing in Joseph's life. Now in his second son, Joseph goes a step further yet. He says when his second son was born, and the second he called Ephraim, which is the Hebrew word fruitful. And he asks the explanation, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. In this confession that God made him fruitful, Joseph goes farther. Notice, God made me fruitful. Not Egypt. Not Pharaoh who chose me to become the second in control. No, none of these people have done that. God has made my land, has made me to be fruitful. In all his life events, Joseph saw the Lord's hand. While in prison, we don't know what he was going, what he's thinking. But he served Potiphar as he served God. Faithful. When he was the keeper of the dungeon, he got the keys of the dungeon. He never ran off. Why not? Because he served God in the dungeon. Faithful. And now he is Pharaoh's second in control, as it were, in the land of Egypt. And still he says, it is God's hand caused me to be fruitful. Do you see God's hand like that? In all the sweet and all the bitter. In all what happens to you, what's been done to you, in providence, through people's hands, through people's actions, through people's injustices, can you leave it with God? And can you say, and God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction? Amazing what he calls Egypt. Children, do you notice that? He has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. Come on, Joseph. Stop talking about afflictions. You got the world on your fingertips. You have everything a man could dream of. You got the finest of Egypt's clothes and jewelry and chariots and the palace and the lands and the honor and the status and the entertainment. You know, think about your rural brothers out there shepherding some sheep. In the heat of the desert, you live in this comfortable Egypt. God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. He hasn't lost his roots. He knows where he belongs. Egypt is still the land of my affliction, even though he is now honored instead of hated. He is now accepted instead of rejected. He is respected instead of mocked, and yet his experience is the land of his affliction. Why? Because he is separated from the land where he belongs. The land of the promise. He is separated from the people to whom he belongs. The people of the promise. He is separated from all that. And therefore Joseph cannot but see Egypt, the land of my afflicted. He rather is identified with the people of God in affliction in Canaan than with all the prosperity of Egypt. Now you see where he looks like Moses when Moses comes to that decisive choice in his life. Do you see? Your world, your situation, your employer, your prosperity, your circumstances in this nation, like Joseph saw it in Egypt. Now that's a question I've been pondering about this week. I'm healthy and I'm prosperous, and I'm rich. In the standards of the world, I'm a rich man. We live in a freer country. We have a country where we can do all the things we kind of like to do. We also have the world on our fingertips. We don't have bombs flying like we have in Aleppo. We don't have to flee like the Christians in Mosul, who now also will be prevented, apparently, from returning to their homeland and their homes. Do you look at the United States as the land of your affliction? In other words, do we have an Ephraim too? Is that a confession of my Christianity? This is the land of my affliction. Yeah, you couldn't see it on Joseph, you say. No, you couldn't see it on the outside. Indeed, but that was not his choice. We have choices. Are we pilgrims? Traveling through the land of affliction? Or have we indeed landed ourselves into this land thinking this is the land we love? America the beautiful. I don't say that cynically. You may be thankful and you may be humble about the land you live in. But it's not beautiful. Far from it. This is the Packers' Day. In Wisconsin. It's not beautiful, congregation. This is a land of affliction to the Christian, isn't it? And sadly, it's not for most of us anymore. For we quite like it. And now if you look yourself again at Joseph, out there, the apex of all the blessings, my blessings, prosperity of the world. Manasseh, Ephraim. That's the grace of God, nothing else. But let it indeed spur us on tonight to seek this God of grace that we may be as sanctified as Joseph was in that land of Egypt. Amen. Let's pray.